From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, Syrian refugees flee to Jordan, living with bird flu in China, and recovering art seized by the Nazis in France. As the civil war rages on inside Syria, the rebels trying to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad have made significant gains in the southern part of the country. The rebels now control most of the border crossings to Jordan, the main exit points for thousands of refugees fleeing the civil war. NPR's Deborah Amos drove to the Syrian border and sent this report.
Our guide on the highway north is Andrew Harper. He heads the UN refugee operation here. He points out the buses filled with Syrians heading to Jordan's refugee camps as we approach the Syrian border.
If you have 2,000 to 3,000 people that cross, so you're talking about 30 or 40 bus trips.
And that's every day?
Every day and every night.
And those numbers are rising to add to the 500,000 already in Jordan. Just a few months ago, Syrian soldiers would shoot at fleeing families crossing in the dark. Now Syrians come by day, in taxis or in pickup trucks, says Harper.
Given that the opposition has gained control of more and more territory on the border, they're actually able to drive relatively close to the border now and get dropped off.
Assalamu alaikum.
The Jordanian military waves us through to the meeting place for the newly arrived.
They walk to here, and so you can see hundreds of refugees under the olive groves there. This is what's terrifying, because there's just so many kids.
Harper is here to find out about the battles across the border. The fighting determines refugee flows. He also wants to know how many Syrians are returning home. In April, some 10,000 headed back after rebels took the town of Da'el in southern Syria and opened a road to this border. In a tent crowded with Syrian families, the stories come all at once. Most are from the town of Jassim, north of Da'el, where rebels and regime loyalists are still fighting. One young mother from Jassim, who wouldn't give her name, said an artillery shell hit her home she packed up the kids 2 days ago for the bleak life of a refugee in Jordan.
It's true that over there in Syria we're dying a fast death, but here in Jordan we're going to be dying a slow one, but this is the way it is.
Some are going back, but it's still too dangerous for most. Even in the rebel-held town of Da'el, says Yasser. He went back to check it out, but decided it wasn't safe.
Do you see people coming back to Da'el?
Yeah, some people are coming back because it's liberated.
And are they staying, or are they just coming to check their houses like you?
Some people are staying and leave their fate with God.
Harper says it's a common story. Most who go back end up making a round trip.
We do have people who do go back to check on elderly parents who refuse to leave despite the conflict, to check on their livestock, their property. Some people go back to the towns and villages to see whether it's actually safe or not.
But even the rebels don't encourage them to stay. There's no food, no water or electricity in rebel-held areas.
The lack of support and assistance that's going on in places like southern Syria just means that people will continue to move towards Jordan, because that's where we are providing assistance.
So far, Jordan has blocked large-scale humanitarian aid into southern Syria, but Jordan is backing the rebels by hosting military training camps, according to Western officials and rebels interviewed here in Amman. For Jordan, reversing the refugee flows is urgent, says analyst Mohammed Abu Rahman.
It is a goal or target to Jordanian government to create a new situation in the southern area of Syria to avoid a huge crisis with the refugees. This is what Jordania now looking for.
It's a gamble that as the rebels gain more territory, Syrian civilians will risk staying home rather than endure Jordan's refugee camps in the soaring summer heat. Southern Syria may become the most important front in the war. Deborah Amos, NPR News, Amman.
living with bird flu in China, and recovering art seized by the Nazis in France. A new strain of bird flu has emerged in China. It's known as H7N9. And health officials around the globe are hoping they're not seeing the early signs of another pandemic. However, more than 30 people have died in the current outbreak, out of the roughly 130 people infected so far. More than half of those deaths occurred in China's second largest city, Shanghai. But as NPR's Frank Langford reports, the residents there seem to be taking the outbreak in their stride.
Every morning here at Shangming High School, there's a nurse named Zhang Hong. She stands at the gate in a white lab coat, and she watches the students come in. Students, a lot of them are wearing tracksuits. It's kind of like a school uniform, and many of them are dragging big roll bags full of books.
If a student feels uncomfortable, we give them a checkup. If their temperature is over 100, we take them to the hospital to see a doctor.
Zhang says she finds two or three students a day with temperatures, but so far none with the virus. And she's not that worried about it.
This time around, the bird flu is not very infectious, and it's not as serious as SARS.
SARS, or severe acute respiratory syndrome, struck South China in late 2002. It eventually infected more than 8,000 people in 32 countries and killed more than 700 worldwide. So far, H7N9 has only infected about 130 people, mostly just here in China. But it could turn out to be much more lethal. At the moment, its death rate is twice that of SARS. Scientists found H7N9 in birds in outdoor markets. Shanghai responded by shutting down live poultry sales and killing more than 100,000 chickens, ducks, and other fowl. Even in this apartment complex where I'm standing right now, managers have penned off a group of black swans on the off chance they become infected. Some restaurants have stopped serving chicken, but people continue to eat it. At a KFC on Nanjing Road, Shanghai's main shopping street, tables are jammed at lunchtime. A man named Yang, who works for a computer chip maker, considers his New Orleans chicken burger.
I'm not worried. It's common knowledge that the virus will be killed under high temperature. So judging by existing reports, it's safe to eat chicken.
Out on the street, Zhang, a 40-year-old office administrator, wears a surgical mask and has sworn off chicken. But she says officials have responded better to this virus than they did to SARS.
It seemed only after SARS had already spread all around the country that the government started to take some action. Now, Shanghai's response is fairly quick. After a few cases were discovered, a news conference was held.
And not everyone is satisfied. Last week, the daughter of a couple infected by H7N9 crashed a press conference to question officials about her father's treatment. She hadn't seen her dad in nearly a month. Officials escorted her out before she could address them. The worry now is H7N9 might adapt and spread easily from person to person. Leo Poon, a virologist at the University of Hong Kong, says the virus already has a couple of key mutations.
These two are quite important, and that may hint that the virus is trying to adapt into humans. I mean, like colleagues in all over the world who work with influenza virus, they're all very concerned about it. Of course, we hope that this will not be another possibility of having a pandemic, but then who knows?
Back at the KFC, Wang Chao, a recent college grad, says he's cut back on his chicken eating. And as long as the virus only spreads from birds to people, he's not too concerned. Human-to-human transmission would be a different story. If that really happens, he says, I would be really worried. And so would everyone else. Frank Langford, NPR News, Shanghai.
During World War II, the Nazis plundered tens of thousands of works of art from the private collections of European Jews, many of them French. About 75% of the stolen art that came back to France after the war was returned to its rightful owners, but approximately 2,000 pieces remain unclaimed. Now the French government has begun an intensive effort to find the rightful owners. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports from Paris.
Millions of visitors a year stroll through French art museums like the Louvre. French law states that art pillaged during World War II must be publicly exhibited if its condition permits so that it can be recognized and claimed. Thierry Bajou is coordinating the French government's latest efforts to speed up that process.
Up until now, France put out the maximum information for public consumption and waited for reaction, for people to come forward. Now we're proactively tracking down the descendants and families of those who had their art stolen.
Historians, regulators, archivists, and curators are working full-time. They're also searching for looted art that may be on the open market. For the first time in France, the buyers and sellers at art auctions that took place between 1938 and 1950 have been revealed. Bajou says it's always complicated when a piece of art is found and the current owner, five or six times removed from and unaware of the original theft, believes he legally owns the piece.
Alors voilà.
Bajou brings up the Culture Ministry's website for looted art. The Jeu de Paume Museum in Paris was the clearinghouse for all the art the Nazis collected around Europe and sent to Germany. A photo taken by the Germans in 1942 shows a room crammed with paintings. Using a special software technology, the full frontal perspective of the painting can be reproduced, even if only a side sliver of the work is visible in the photo.
Ici, on voit une signature Picasso.
You see, now you can even read the signature on this one, says Bajou. It's signed Picasso. Bajou says it was easier for the bigger collectors to get back their artworks after the war because they were usually well documented.
What's complicated is if you were just a normal guy and had maybe one piece of art that was in your family. It's difficult to link the work to the person because most times during the war, the families lost all their records and any photos or insurance claims, any proof that the art was theirs.
Thank you very much.
The new efforts have already produced results. In a ceremony at the French Culture Ministry in March, six paintings were returned to 82-year-old Bostonian Tom Seldorf. Seldorf was 6 years old when he saw his grandfather's prized art collection for the last time in 1930s Vienna.
I only wish my grandfather were here to be able to be part of all this. But I'm sure he's watching from somewhere upstairs. So that's fine. Thank you very much.
Seldorf's grandfather, Jewish industrialist Richard Neumann, fled to France in 1938 after the Anschluss, but he was soon forced to flee again, selling off his collection for a song. He made it to Cuba alive, but penniless. Records show his paintings were destined for a German Louvre Hitler planned in the Austrian town of Linz. I visit French Senator Corinne Bouchoux, a major force behind the new initiative. She says France has not done enough in the past decades to return the paintings and calls it the country's moral duty.
This problem was sort of left in the freezer of history after 1950, and it was the conjunction of two events that revived it. The fall of the Berlin Wall, which gave us access to the Soviet archives, and the Internet. Before the Internet, if you lived in Brazil and your family had missing works, you couldn't search the French collections of stolen art. Now, you can.
But even with Internet, it's still difficult, says Bajou. Looking at the Culture Ministry's website, he points to three paintings by artist Fedor Lowenstein. They were considered degenerate art, and Nazi records show they had been destroyed. So no one ever looked for them, says Bajou. But they were recently discovered in the negatives of the photos the Nazis took. As it turns out, the Lowensteins were in storage at the Pompidou Center, classified as an anonymous donation by a careless curator in 1973. Bajou says that should never have happened, and now the French government is trying to return the paintings. Lowenstein had no children, says Bajou, but he may have had a sibling who may have had a child. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.